All right, we are back. Another Presidio Bitcoin Jam. Welcome, guys.
Woohoo!
Hey, it's been a minute.
Oh,
yeah, a minute.
Too many minutes.
Didn't you say May Day? Today's May Day, right?
Today's May Day.
What does that mean?
Yeah, what does
like
that mean?
The 1st of May?
Yeah. I don't know. When I grew up in Iowa, that was a thing.
I've heard of it. Yeah, growing up in the Midwest.
I don't know if it's an Iowa thing or an old person thing.
I thought
or
it was
what,
like a... I thought
it was like a socialist day.
Doing like ribbons around a pole or something?
No, as kids, it was a big day because you go to school and you got a little like cup of candy and...
Oh.
Really? Yeah, I thought maybe I'm getting the dates wrong, but this was some sort of like International Workers' Day, which I thought would be ironic for our audience. Although, a plug, you never listen to me talk with Ben Ark about how Bitcoin actually is a merger of all kinds of both capitalist and socialist philosophies, new philosophy. It's interesting.
Yeah. And Cinco de Mayo is coming up too. So,
oh, exactly.
Don't forget about that one.
Yeah.
May the 4th be with you.
Get your tequila paid in Bitcoin.
We've got a lot of holidays here.
Yeah. But yeah, it's good to be back at our normally scheduled time. And I think as far as we know, we're going to be sticking with that for quite a while.
Yeah. And I know we have so much to cover. We don't want to talk too much personal stuff. Lots, happened off the air. Good, bad, all in between. But one personal thing I do want to mention to you, Steve, because it's pretty important. I've been watching one minor obsession I have, not so minor, is the recruiting game. And I know our people are missing basketball, but I'm watching, NIL budgets in Memphis and all this. There's been some losses, but some good things. And I noticed Memphis has a game in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Is that North Dakota, South Dakota? South Dakota.
It's up.
Against Iowa State next year.
Really?
So we may have to do a little PB road trip up there.
Wow.
Yeah,
I would
DK, if you want to come and get indoctrinated.
Right.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I just found it out yesterday.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so
we should definitely go.
Yeah, let's figure it out.
I can.
Sadly, Iowa State's probably much better, so it'll be a sad trip for me. But yeah, fuck it.
We just extended our coach 10-year contract, $6 million a year. He's one of the top 7 paid coaches now, which is. That might not sound like a big deal, but coming from ISU's little budget,
it's impressive. Yeah. So anyway, enough basketball, but
okay,
there.
We got stuff to cover.
Yeah, let's start with, we have so much to cover because it's been, a lot of happening. And plus we haven't had a show for a week and a half or something like that.
Two weeks, hasn't it? Or
we had like a makeup week, Tuesday edition.
Yeah.
So let's start with Vegas.
Yeah.
None of us went to Vegas.
But there are
a lot of interesting announcements there and new products. And yeah, let's start with that.
Yeah.
Let's start with Block, my own company. Lots of exciting stuff. So one is the new BitKey, which I was gonna maybe show off in the show, but I don't think the display shows up really well. But anyone familiar with BitKey, it's a Bitcoin hardware wallet. Really great UX, really great feel. But the one knock on it since it launched was that there's no display, and they've now added a display. And I just showed it to you guys before the show.
Sick.
And it's great.
Yeah.
It's a great great touchscreen, great feel.
And the importance of the display.
And it allows you to verify the Bitcoin address you're sending your Bitcoin to.
Right.
And what I didn't demonstrate to you, it also allows you to verify the address that your deposit address too.
Oh,
so like for example, if you buy Bitcoin on Coinbase or Cash App or Kraken or whatever, and you want to send it to a wallet, if you're just using a software UI on your laptop, it could replace the address that you think you're trying to send it to.
Yeah,
and then a attacker would steal your Bitcoin. So here, when you get to see your deposit address on the BitKey, you have much greater assurance.
And,
so,
and from what Steve just showed us, I think one of the other really nice things is this is super sort of mainstream or noob friendly. I mean, it looks like an Apple style experience, like a little animation. Like it's just really, really 12 out of 10 classily done. So
yeah, nice job. We did. Thanks to the team.
Yeah.
I didn't do it, but happy to talk about it. We covered BitKey and a lot of other custody options, anywhere from ETFs to Trezors, etc. Last January, 2025.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah,
just sent that episode to someone who was asking me about this because I think everything we covered in that episode is still, it's kind of a timeless piece in some sense. Nothing's changed that would change, I think, any of our views or what we shared in that show. So people could go check that out. That was actually before it was called PBJ. It was it's in DK's YouTube.
Oh,
but we did
curious DK jam.
Alex did do the work to import all of those pre PBJ shows into Apple Podcasts. So it's
that was November. That was the first one.
Oh, okay.
I think this one was
But November through February.
Like remote or something?
Those shows have been, if you go to PBJ on Apple Podcasts, you can find all those shows too under PBJ. But if you want to watch us, the YouTube, not in the studio, which you probably don't want to do, doesn't really add much value, you have to go to DK's YouTube.
Make sure to hit subscribe and smash that like button when you're there.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
By the way, I mentioned Alex. We have our fearless leader back in the studio today as our producer.
Welcome back, Alex.
Woo!
Thank you. I think a testament to the job Alex did to get production up and running and humming and consistent and high quality and easy, a good UX, is that Ashu filled in for 3 months or so and did a great job too.
We're happy
to have Alex back.
Anyway,
so I mean, the high level of BitKey, I think it's unquestionably like 1,000x better UX than other hardware wallets. So then the question is, does it give you like the security, privacy, sovereignty you might want? And that team has closed many of the gaps that existed from the initial launch with any other solution. So I think for a lot of people, it's absolutely the right trade-off. Mm-hmm. And would love to see that team, you know, continue moving the needle on security and privacy and closing those gaps. But definitely, if you want to self-custody, but you feel like you don't have the time, patience, or you're just scared of some of the solutions out there, check out BitKey. Or maybe you've already sort of done that work and you feel confident in it, but you know that your friends and family members probably would trip over themselves trying to do it, then I think BitKey would be a good solution to have a look at.
And I think, I mean, you can go back and listen to that earlier episode Steve mentioned, but I think it's worth just reminding that unlike something like a Trezor or Ledger, it's not just like a pure sort of seed phrase, like self-custody to your own thing. This is still multi-sig. And so for, I think, both advanced users and especially noob users, the fact that you have the option to have, okay, there's, as I understand, a shard of the key in the device, phone, and with block, you need two of the three. And there's also ways to recreate that with like social recovery as well that you can enter like your family members. And so for a lot of noob users, frankly, it's just like a lot more comfort than, oh shit, if I mess up this one thing, it's gone.
And importantly, I think this, I'm sure, maintains, which is block can go out of business and you can still recover your Bitcoin.
Exactly.
So you're not dependent on a corporation to exist in order for you to be able to still have self-sovereign Bitcoin.
That's right.
Yep. So that's true. So it is self-sovereign. Don't trust certain social media accounts saying it's not portable. It is seedless, which is controversial with, at least with other vendors that sell seed phrase based products. But there's a lot of careful attention making sure that people can retain control of their Bitcoin, even if block goes away.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned the two or three multisig. Anyone who's tried to do multisig, sort of a do-it-yourself or solution, sees that it's more complicated than a single signature, but it is definitely more secure. BitKey makes that a seamless experience. The customer literally doesn't even really need to know what multisig is. They can just use the product, but they're getting the assurances of up to a three multisig. So,
and I'm trying to remember, on BitKey, was there a time delayed vaulting service related to that, or that wasn't part of it?
That's not part of it. They the team did add inheritance though.
Cool.
And so.
Cool. Plus one request for that feature.
The vaulting?
Yeah. If there's a big key team.
I'm curious, at the protocol level or the application level? For example, Coinbase, and I think River added this at the application level, which is, that's still good, but it means that like you could still have social engineering or like an insider attack. At the protocol level means that the company can't be, the vendor can't be compromised. And
I think in the cases of River, they have just like a pool of Bitcoin. So if you tried to receive or send, you're receiving or sending into a pool, right? They don't give you like the addresses where your Bitcoin lives.
But I don't think they're actually time locking at the protocol level. I think
that's what I'm saying. Is like it wouldn't make sense to, because
Coinbase has had a vault product or feature like
application level
for 10 years. Application level.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
And I think that's what River added.
If you have
so it makes just
Bitcoin,
as much sense with River as it does for Coinbase.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense to have protocol level locking if otherwise you're managing everything through a pool.
Right. But I raised this question to you guys because BitKey's not custodial.
I mean, my initial reaction, I mean, I think it depends on the user. Personally, I'd rather protocol level, I think, but that's maybe a bit of a more advanced feature. I could see maybe it's like application level, and then there's like, if there's like a setting, if you're an advanced user and you want to go and do protocol level, then maybe that's an option too.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, protocol level, I mean, it's clearly has the advantage of you're resilient against the vendor attack, whether it be intentional by vendor or a hacker. But it's more complicated. So I think there's some, you know, some UX gotchas there.
But yeah. I do like vaulting from the perspective, like we've talked before about custody diversification.
Right.
I think that's a core message that I rarely hear anybody talk about. And I think it's an important message that I think you originally shared whatever a year or whenever ago that was. But I think vaulting is like also part of that, which is being able to protect yourself from a wrench attack to some extent. Like we know the guy who got, you know, the kind of the wrench attack here in San Francisco. And if he said, look, here's my thing, and we've got to wait, you know, 2 weeks, that's actually a pretty good scenario. So I think there's like a, you know, anti-wrench attack or personal safety that vaulting, a visible vault can help with.
Yep. Okay. I'll send the segment to the team. And
One other, I guess not exactly feature request, but question, does it support Lightning yet? And is that on the roadmap?
It does not support Lightning yet. Unclear if and when. And there's a variety of approaches to supporting Lightning as well.
Yeah.
I think today BitKey is, you know, it's the best fit for it is someone looking to just HODL and save, much like any other hardware wallet. Mm-hmm. So I think that's today's use case.
It's a great starting point.
You can't, I mean, that said, from the BitKey mobile app, you can spend and you can set a limit, a threshold where you can spend even without using the hardware device.
Well, that's what I was getting into.
Spending on chain.
But it's spending on chain.
So, I mean, I'm assuming you guys have already thought through this, but I see the sort of product evolution, two reasons I asked that. One is, okay, so you've got your savings account now with BitKey and then your checking account being Lightning. And so when you're actually using that at a Square merchant or whatever, getting your cash back, like obviously Lightning would be preferable there, but also for potentially privacy. And as Lightning is able to take larger amounts, that could be interesting to move in and out.
I mean, we have so much to cover today. Yeah. We probably don't want to go there, but I mean, just think about stuff we've talked in the past. How would you implement it? Yeah. So if you implement it just a Lightning node, then you have all the challenges with economics and scaling and stuff like that. Or you could choose like Arc or Spark or Cashew, but each of those has questions and stuff too, trade-offs. So there's not like a clear winner on how to do that.
I could see, and I totally understand that there's always the trade-off, but like for maybe more advanced users in this setting, like actually getting a dedicated node. Like if you're going to make this like one of your primary, you know.
Well, but running on a server? A Lexi like design would be good.
The Lexi design would actually be better, which is running it in a secure enclave in the cloud.
So then Block would have to build something like Lex, the technology that Lexi has, right? So,
hope you're listening to this, Max.
another approach, like the sort of dummy approach or simple approach is like, you just have two separate wallets.
Yeah.
You have the savings wallet and the spending wallet and they're separate. But when you get to that point, then it's like, well, I already have you can just use Phoenix or Lexi or a spending wallet.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot of, I guess
you can do it to Cash App too.
There's a little bit of advantage by integrating the two, but in any case, the bottom line is it does not support that today.
Cool.
Yeah.
But it's sick.
That's one announcement from Vegas. Right. That's just one Block announcement from Vegas. Okay. We got more, so let's
keep going.
Keep going. So a few quick things from NFC payments were shown, which is super cool.
Yeah,
like it's a great UX win. So specifically, Square now will be able to do NFC tap to pay, and it's a really did you guys see the demo video? It's super slick. So you just the challenge is always, I mean, first of all, is it even supported in the, in Square and the wallet? But then if you have to like open up, if you can't like double tap to pay like Apple Pay, that still kind of sucks. You have to go open up the app. But what's slick about it, you just tap your device to the Square terminal and a notification pops up on your phone that you tap and then it loads Cash App and then you pay. So
NFC can trigger a node for a specific app.
Yeah.
And then that can just be opened up.
Yeah. I don't know if it uses the express transit mode or what, but like when you're in Tokyo and you go to the subway, you just like put your phone on the gate and you walk through. Mm-hmm. You don't have to open up an app. You don't have to double tap. It just
you don't have to
unlock your screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it works and it pops up a notification. So
and that's
you do have like an approval step though, no?
Well, yeah. So it automatically shows a notification. You tap on it, then you approve in Cash App.
Got it.
But it's just a slick experience because you're not having to like hunt around your phone to open Cash App and then provide it context. It has the context. It automatically, you know, well, it doesn't automatically. You have to tap. But it's a slick user experience.
Yeah. Cool.
So that's a huge win for UX.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
And like, there's a bunch of Cashew wallets that support NFC now. Mm-hmm. Phoenix supports it. I mean, so there's a lot of wallets that support NFC. Mm-hmm. Now Square does. So. And now that this is being demonstrated, you're kind of behind. If you're a wallet and you don't support this, you gotta catch up. So it's on its way to being ubiquitous.
Cool.
So that's super cool.
But to be clear, that's not live yet. That's launching soon, or
I think it's gonna be rolled out soon on Square.
Cool.
And
NFC the standard.
I think it's live on the Cashew wallets. It's definitely live on Phoenix. I think Zeus supports it too.
I mean, Albi and Lexi and MDK.
Cash App soon. And Lexi should do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. 5% cash back.
That's sick.
Or Bitcoin back.
I love that.
Do you like that?
Back on one.
Back on track.
If you use Cash App to buy something on Square, mm-hmm. then you get 5% Bitcoin back, through the end of the year. Or something like that.
Only if you use Bitcoin, like if you use Cash App Pay, for example, do you still get it, or is it just Bitcoin?
I think you have to use the Lightning. So either dollars in Lightning or Bitcoin.
Sweet. We get 5% cash back at launch.
Yep. So that's good incentive. Peer-to-peer payments. You can turn into Bitcoin. I didn't use this yet, so I can only... I believe this is... You know, Cash App supports peer-to-peer payments. You can now set it up so that, like, let's say you pay back for lunch or something, and you're not a Bitcoin. You just do the normal thing. You send me $20 or whatever. I can have it set up so that all or a portion of that $20 I receive goes to Bitcoin.
Hmm. Oh, so
it's just a slicker use. It
means two Cash Apps. That can kind of use similar
so
mechanics
just creates
you would
a
with a merchant.
Slicker experience to convert some or all of your peer-to-peer payments to Bitcoin. So it's nice because like if I love Bitcoin and I want Bitcoin, I want you to pay me in Bitcoin. Well, I don't have to like, you know, try to convince you.
Right,
you just send me money the way you want to and then I get Bitcoin.
Now, the way I read that, maybe I misread this, was I thought, so right now, like if I pay you, or it's always been the case on Cash App, I can just put in your cash tag and pay you there, peer-to-peer payment. I thought they were moving all of those from internal database entries to Lightning. Is that true, or did I misread that?
There's something like that.
Okay.
Don't test me on it. I couldn't tell you an accurate picture of that, but it's something
Well, if
like
that's
that.
The case,
but,
that would meaningfully add
regardless,
volume. So.
Regardless, you can definitely open Cash App now, and I like... pay my cash tag. Like that still works.
Sweet.
Love so, and let's see, I think the last thing from Block is the proof of reserves was announced. Mm-hmm. And you asked about that. And I said, well, we already talked about River, but I did a little bit more homework. Mm. I'm pretty sure this is correct. So, I got confirmation from Claude as well as confirmation from BuilderBot, which is Block's internal, AI bot that's integrated into Slack, which we should talk more about later in the show, confirming my understanding. But I think Block, like River, had, years ago, whatever, launched proof of reserves and proof of liabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So with River, you can see you can independently verify how much Bitcoin they control
mm-hmm.
and how much Bitcoin liabilities they have for their customers,
mm-hmm.
And
how do you, I could imagine presenting the addresses to prove what Bitcoin addresses they...
How do you prove your liabilities?
Yeah.
So they publish a Merkle tree of every customer's balance anonymously. So then at the leaves of this tree are every single account that they have. That by itself doesn't prove it.
Right.
And if only you look at your own account, that doesn't fully prove it, but obviously if you look at your own account that gives you confidence.
Mm-hmm.
If
my account balance weren't there, I would say sounds problematic.
So what it does, what it like where you really gain confidence is any River customer looks up their account in this Merkle tree and it's not there, or the balance is wrong, or something's wrong about it, then I would advise contacting River. If you don't get a good answer, then scream to the world.
When you say their account, I assumed we were just looking at like a balance amount. Is there some user ID, account ID that gets wrapped into that somehow?
Somehow you can find your account. I forget how they anonymize it, but it doesn't. It's not like they publish a tree saying like DK has
social security
$1 billion of money at this account.
Look, brother, up.
Yeah, I forget the details, but there's some way that you can find your account,
right?
That's anonymous. So I can't find your account.
Yeah. So I can verify this number corresponds to this balance.
Yeah. So if you can't, if it's inaccurate or missing, mm-hmm. then you would raise a five alarm bell.
Yeah.
So that's where everyone can collectively gain confidence in the proof of liabilities. So getting back to what Block announced the proof of reserves. I believe it works similarly to River, but the proof of, I don't think Block announced proof of liabilities. That's where my AI buddies are confirming that, but I haven't had a human in charge mm-hmm. of this stuff confirm that yet. But I think that's the case. So if that is true, my take on it, it's definitely a win getting proof of reserves out there, and it's better to have that yep. than not have that. Yeah. So good job, Block. But it's a whole lot better when you have proof of liabilities as well. And as we've talked about in the show before, that still is not proof of everything. Like, you can have a company, you can fully have a proof right. that they have this much Bitcoin and they owe this much Bitcoin, but they might have like fiat liabilities or other liabilities that can still make them go bankrupt and then you lose your money. So, I mean, none of this is perfect, but it's absolutely the right direction.
Good steps in the right direction.
Yeah. For companies to do. So
it's harder to
good
be
job,
bad app.
Good job. Yeah, good job, River. Yeah. Good job, Block. And hopefully others follow suit.
One comment on that. So first of all, I love all this, and not to steal your thunder, because I know another announcement has to do with withdrawal limits, which I think is related to this. One thing I will say, I think it's awesome that Block is doing this, and Block has certainly been leading the way. I will say I was a little surprised. If I remember correctly, I think it's like slightly under 20K BTC, like old school Bitcoin for customers, and I think another like 8 or 9K for Block. I actually would have assumed it was more than that, given how long Cash App has been in the game. I understand they serve more like individual, probably smaller balances. But
The answer is a year ago, I think at Bitcoin Vegas, Miles Suter announced that 8% of entire Bitcoin block space mm-hmm. is Cash App.
So
a lot of Cash, that implies a lot of Cash App customers withdraw.
Got it.
And if you look at internal data, that happens, and then you can see where it's going. And there's a lot of people self-custody, or some people are moving. I mean, some people are doing payments, like moving money to like they're buying things actually, or they'll move it to exchanges and do crypto trades or whatever. I mean, all kinds of uses. But I mean, the bottom line, lots of customers move their Bitcoin off of Cash App.
Yeah. Does the proof of reserve? I wouldn't consider this a bad thing, but just for understanding, is it a pooled model where you see a few addresses that have all of the Bitcoin, or is it everybody has their own addresses that correspond? And
not the latter, because it's way more efficient, and economical to pool, and interestingly more private in certain ways. Mm-hmm. But the way River works, I mean, it's obviously you can point to this public address saying here there's this much Bitcoin in that address, it's ours, and then how do you prove it's ours? Well, I mean, one, you can sign a message, but I believe the way River does it is that they will spend a small amount on it, and in that transaction that spends it, they I think the amount they choose is like linked to the previous block's hash or something that proves it was done now. If they're attesting to like we own this much Bitcoin now, and then they follow up with a transaction that that matches that.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So one other question on that. I think it's great that Block has been more transactional about encouraging people to use their Bitcoin. With BitKey, obviously, they don't want you to keep Bitcoin on the exchange. That's great. But I also wonder, I don't know how much you can talk about this, but given that they're also increasing withdrawal limits, which were crazy low in the past. So I'm curious how high the limits are, number one, which is great. But number two, do you see this as a move that Block, in addition to wanting people to go with BitKey, is going to move more up market as well and let people, you know, that are buying larger amounts of Bitcoin or maybe want to keep more Bitcoin on exchange because they trust Block more than others. Is that a directional shift or not really?
I think it is. And I'm trying to remember the source. I think it was Public.
Okay. Yeah. Alpha Drop right here. That's why you turn into PBJ.
I think it was Public.
We grill Steve and get the...
Maybe I dreamt this in case it was...
Yeah, it's...
But no, like, totally I think they're seeking incentives to, like, no fees or lower fees if you buy a larger amount or stuff like that. So I think there's definitely an interest in going up market. And obviously the... raising the withdrawal limits was key to that, right?
Do you know what they are now?
I actually don't know what they are. I mean, it was like, I don't think they announced that now, right? Oh, I mean, no, well, they definitely last fall they did.
Yeah.
I don't know if I didn't see anything new, but last fall this was addressed in a pretty big way. It was a long-standing, probably the biggest criticism of the product by Bitcoiners.
Yeah.
Because they were such low limits.
Although it was also a nice security feature. Because you just can't get your Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I don't know what they are now, but I mean, it's dramatically better.
Yeah.
You don't feel locked in now.
Nice.
Because people who had been on Cash App for a long time, because Bitcoin appreciates a lot, and the limits are in dollars, not Bitcoin amounts, right?
Yeah. Right.
So you bought a little bit of Bitcoin in 2017, 2018 on Cash App, and all of a sudden it far exceeded their thresholds, and you spend all year
good problem
trying to get your money out, right? So that's been improved. Cool. Yeah. So I think enough about Block. Let's see. Are you prepared to talk about Aven?
I can, yeah.
All right, let's talk. So I know it at a really high level, but I think it's an interesting product. So let's talk about it.
Yeah. Well, so the thing that was announced, there's this company called Aven. It's a San Francisco-based startup. And fintech, been around since 2019. And the mission of the company has always been make your assets, give you liquid access to your assets. I had met Saudi before he started the company, and he was trying to help people avoid taking payday loans by being able to unlock the equity of their car.
Oh, man.
Right? Crazy, right?
Oh, okay.
But that is, the mission has always been, how do we do that? And the main bulk of the...
Digital pawn shop.
The bulk of the kind of assets that they're unlocking that liquidity for over the last, since 2019, has mostly been homes. So people have homes, they have home equity, they've made mortgage payments for years, or the home is appreciated, and there's equity that they own. That's their asset equity. And historically, the only way to tap that is to get a home equity line of credit, the HELOC. And I think those, you kind of have to do it in a chunk. You're like, oh, I'm going to take 50K of liquidity or 100K of liquidity. And so those are kind of like big numbers to do big projects, but it's not like daily spending or daily liquidity. Just, I want to buy lunch today and I'll just, borrow off my Bitcoin stack or off my house. And so that's been kind of the mission of the company. Totally agnostic to Bitcoin, just a fintech. They're not like, oh, we're Bitcoin or let's, make this happen for Bitcoin. They're like, let's make this financial services product happen for the world. This week is the first I heard of it. They actually just launched this Bitcoin-backed loans. So they said, well, this is another asset that people hold. And all the stuff that we've done with the home equity and the card swipes, we can now do with, Bitcoin as the asset. So if you have Bitcoin, you custody it with them. I think it's done through BitGo. I think they do keep it in isolated addresses so that there is no rehypothecation that's verifiable. And you can have Bitcoin stack there, and then you get issued a card. You just swipe your card at lunch. You can swipe it anywhere, and you start drawing down on your stack for liquidity whenever you spend it. Benefit is you're not paying interest on stuff that you're not using. You only pay interest on whatever you're currently drawing out.
And so this is a line of credit then, or?
Yeah, it's a line of credit.
Okay.
Yeah. A Bitcoin-backed line of credit. Yeah.
How does
tied
this,
to a card.
How does this, and I actually noticed a lot of their investors are actually the same, but how does this compare to where Lava is today? Or do you have any sense of, is it basically the same?
Well, Lava doesn't have a card at the moment.
I thought they were launched. Isn't it live yet?
I think they've been talking about it.
Yeah.
I was supposed to receive one a year and a half ago to test with, and I did not receive
it. She's on if you're listening. We want our cards.
Yeah. I don't want to make any pre-announcements. I think that's part of the plan of where they would like to be, but I don't think it's currently.
And then what about line of credit? Does Lava support that now or not? There's definitely been some products, like line of credit is like a, there's like a trend right now. And I think several, maybe a few other products support line of credit.
But you maybe say line of credit, do you mean separate? Okay, separate from a separate denominated from a
yeah.
Single just like
loan.
You said, I mean, you don't get charged interest on the whole amount. It's
right.
Rolling.
It's a typical line of credit. I mean, typical line of credit, but you can back it with Bitcoin. I think a few other products support that. But I think what's novel about Aven is if you have an actual physical card.
Yeah.
That you're, and I assume
it's
like, Visa or.
Yeah.
So.
Cool.
So that makes it pretty interesting.
What I saw, I think it was like
on the rates
too.
The rates are also
between 30-70% loan to value. So it's a pretty wide range.
Wow.
And you get different rates depending on where you fall on that. But the highest rate I thought was somewhere around maybe 11%. The lowest rate was like around 7 or 8%. Which if you're STRC bull. Some people are. I'm not not financial advice, but
but doesn't Coinbase starting, offer like 4 or 5%?
But this is on Morpho? Like this is on like up to I think $1 million.
Yeah.
Where I think Coinbase caps at $100K maybe and has the Morpho Aave rehypothecation stuff going on.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't know about the there's definitely the Morpho stuff. I don't think
Morpheus is I believe.
Aave. I hope it's not Aave because
maybe it's
broke, right?
So. Okay, maybe it's not Aave. I'm not saying. I think there's some.
But Morpho didn't break, and I'm not an expert in that stuff. But Morpho, I think, is more resilient than Aave. At least I hope so because Aave just broke.
But I think Morpho has that like when liquidity dries up, it dries up fast because it's all kind of retail providing liquidity instead of
I think it's dynamic
big liquidity.
Rates.
Yeah, dynamic rates can cause you to get liquidated if the LTV changes all of a sudden, right?
Yeah. Interesting.
But I wasn't aware of the Coinbase limit. But then Surge works out of PB here.
Yep.
They're in this game too, right?
Yep.
And I spoke briefly with them this morning. They were in Vegas. They said it was hopping and they had a booth there.
Okay.
So I'm not a huge booth fan in general, but if you're a startup trying to create awareness. It's a good way to measure like who swings by, what do they have to say, what's their reaction to your
almost
product
like
and your messaging.
It's definitely their clientele. So.
Yeah. So for that it's valuable. And it sounds like they had great traffic flow. And I asked them like the people who stopped by the booth, who were they? Were they people who already have Bitcoin back loans or they don't, but they are doing research and trying to pick one, or they just weren't even aware of it. And it sounds like a lot of people already have Bitcoin-backed self loans, and then they were they liked the self-custody pitch of Surge, which is obviously...
We've always loved the self-custody.
We love that.
We loved that pitch 4 years ago with Lava. Yeah. So it's nice to see... it is harder to implement, and there's various challenges bringing that to market, but I'm super happy someone is...
And Surge
still
is taking
that?
A different approach to implement. Like,
they're not
the past,
using DLCs.
Yeah.
Lava was a DLC approach that ultimately didn't pan out. They're taking this like signer network. So the liquidity providers have the ability to sign and review kind of what goes in. Yeah,
the MPC or multi-party computation that Coinbase kind of pioneered.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, correct me if you have a different view, but I think it's like not quite as self-sovereign as using DLC approach, but pretty darn, I mean, the best out there and pretty close.
Yeah.
And it has some advantages over the DLC approach too, just in terms of like UX and technical viability, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where it lands. So
it's
definitely
cool.
Nice to have.
I feel like this whole market, the rates of these things are now coming down where they.
Well, aren't, I might be wrong, but aren't they offering like 6% rates on Surge?
Oh,
I didn't know that.
I didn't see that. I mean, that kind of would surprise me, but it could be true.
If so, I'd be curious how they're doing that.
Yeah, because like, I think part of the challenge in this market is if you go with like a retail who just want to make a little, yield on their stuff, they can be kind of finicky. You don't have long-term relationships. Whereas if you go with a standard liquidity provider, large scale, much deeper, but they also are going to probably want you to custody it.
Yeah.
Like they don't want to take risk on what is the signer network and do we have to do technical analysis on how good is this?
Rates from 6.9% APR. So
from.
You have to dig. Yeah, you have exactly. to dig into the details here.
Yeah, exactly. Let's
I mean, we can part. Pop out and ask them really quick. But anyway,
yeah.
I mean, clearly, everyone cares about the rates, right? I mean, whether you're sovereign or whatever, like you hear about the rates. So.
And people who care about sovereignty will give up sovereignty for the rate. And so the rate really—that's
the rate really matters. But also liquidity. I mean, you know, you said LTVs. Also, liquidation too.
Yes,
like there's details there too. Yep, if you
may originate a loan with a 70% LTV.
Yeah, if you start at let's say 50% LTV.
Okay. Yeah,
but then at 80%, you get liquidated. But you get partial liquidated?
It's the other
or full?
Right? Wouldn't it be I take it out with an 80% LTV,
and then it drops, and then if it drops 30% or something?
Yeah,
and then. Or, you know, so like, are you doing full liquidation or partial liquidation? There's a lot of variables there and then you mentioned previously Coinbase. I had forgotten they had a 100K limit, but you know, the amount you want to borrow.
I haven't tracked it.
If you're trying to, you know, buy a home or whatever, and you have to put 300K down or something, then if something has 100K limit, that only partially helps you.
And for me, I mean, that's something I've looked actually quite a bit into. It's still not live, this Coinbase home equity loan product. And I still actually want to follow up and learn more about y'all's friends that's doing this. But increasingly, I see this as just part of the broader trend of basically using Bitcoin as a collateral capital asset to like strengthen financial markets overall. I think that's going to continue to accelerate. And particularly what gets me the most excited is the ability to not have any liquidation. So the Coinbase product, as we discussed a couple months ago, it's still not live. So I want to see it actually work in progress. But and I think you're going to see a whole bunch of these, not just with homes, but with other kind of collateral types as well, like potential financial products.
What was the LTV for that? 25?
It's a 40% LTV. Is that right? No, I think it was 40% LTV, or was it 60%? I forget the exact number.
40 would be my guess.
Okay.
I think it was below 50.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say 40% LTV.
Meaning like you put in 100K of Bitcoin deposited with Coinbase, you take 40K of liquidity.
That's right.
Okay.
And I think, but the key thing was, but it's sort of, I forget the exact way it was structured, but it's a double collateralized. And I think you're going to see this with financial assets, potentially LP stakes and funds and all kinds of other stuff, where if you have a really secure other asset, you can double collateralize and get creative with how you do that. Then what they're basically saying is for as long as you own this home loan, we're never going to liquidate you. That to me matters a ton, because if you want to buy something like a house, it would suck if all of a sudden you're like, oh shit, I got whatever, we had a flash crash today, I can't get the money together, and now I'm going to lose my house. Like,
watch out, guys. Our producer is in the chat now.
Uh-oh. Nice.
Anyway.
What are you saying?
Surge.build.
I mean, the beauty of a home traditionally is that the way Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the way the whole sort of mortgage industrial complex works is it's not a callable loan, right? So that asset doesn't get repriced every day. Right, it gets repriced every 10 years or whenever you sell it, right? And so that's a fairly stable asset. And you have a mismatch when you have, you know, Bitcoin is a highly liquid, you know, repricing every minute. So I think having it cross-collateralized, you actually are reducing risk substantially because of the illiquid pairing with the liquid.
Yep.
So one vendor we've not mentioned is Strike.
Right.
They also offer Bitcoin-backed loans. And we also just talked about limits, right? And what I heard is Jack Mallers in Vegas is saying, we can fulfill any loan. Give me a call or whatever, message me. Because the news there is that, well, I think the news is it's being explored by Tether. Tether Investments. Was it a done deal or explored?
I thought it was announced that it was happening.
Okay.
It's never clear in this kind of market.
We didn't receive any paper.
Whether,
I'm still waiting.
The SEC has approved this or not,
when
I don't know.
We're going to find out, exactly.
But a merger of Strike and XXI, which is
21.
Tether's, 21. Tether's basically strategy, you know, Bitcoin treasury.
Did that already do the, wasn't CEP, Cantor Equity Partners, was like the vehicle that was going to take it public in a SPAC or whatever.
I think that's done.
So now it's 21.
But I think
there's like a ticker.
Because I believe saw the stock price moved when this was announced.
Okay.
So that public company plus Strike, which I think we maybe even like talked about that when Jack Mallers became CEO of 21.
Right.
That like, okay, the next move would be to
wonder what's next.
Acquire Strike. But what we did not speculate on and what was announced is also the mining arm of Tether, which I'm...
Equa something? Was
yeah.
It?
No. Oh, Electron.
Yeah. Electron, yeah.
Electron, which is like side drama there. Like Swan is suing Tether because there was some some kind of partnership on and then, you know, I don't know the details or the facts or what the outcome of that case will be, but the bottom line is Electron is a very large Bitcoin miner, maybe the largest in the world.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It's a huge amount of hash.
Like 5% of hash or something like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so now you have this combined entity, which, you know, maybe it's not technically part of Tether, but it's kind of like Elon Co. I mean, like, yeah. You know.
Like, you know where that's going.
you sort of know where that's going. And clearly there's like vested economic interests and control and power. And yeah. So you have Tether, which has immense assets, Bitcoin and otherwise, U.S. treasuries, etc. And then you have Strike and all of its consumer and retail products and financial services. And you have this maybe largest Bitcoin miner in the world. That's a pretty interesting combination. And it's also why, I mean, if it is true, Jack Mallers is saying like, hey, we'll service any loan amount you want. It actually has some credibility behind it because they have a ton of money.
Well, didn't Tether put $2.1 billion, did I see? Or they put a huge balance amount. Sheet together for the 21 Corp, I think. So they probably can make big loans and they have their own liquidity provider.
And that, not to mention they're making billions of dollars every
so
year.
So it'll be interesting. I don't think they announced anything that like a stretch competitor, but it wouldn't take too much imagination that they see the opportunity that Strategy has with Stretch. And they're like, we want a piece of that as well.
It's a little messy to me.
Yeah.
It's kind of the opposite strategy, right? One is create cash flow and native Bitcoin and put that on the balance sheet. And the other is like, make fiat eat itself. And those seem like different kind of propositions.
Yeah. I want to get your take on this. I haven't thought super deeply about this. What I love with MicroStrategy and Stretch is the product is just like dead simple and very, very clear. It's like, we're going to basically buy Bitcoin, over collateralize it, offer some of the yield, a third of the yield or whatever it is that we project to people that don't want to buy the Bitcoin but want the yield. Great. Super simple. Speculative attack on the dollar. Amazing. For these new kinds of companies like 21, I mean, I'm wondering what advantages. So there's certainly advantages to scale for doing lending, right? Like the more Bitcoin or the more capital you have, you can get better rates, maybe do like more leniency on things like the way you underwrite and margin call, stuff like that. So that's good. I don't really see the value of like bringing a miner in yet. I haven't thought a ton about this, but like, yeah, I mean,
my understanding is at least the way they talk about it, is that the purpose of the 21 org is to build products and services for the world that generate native Bitcoin revenue yield, right? So a hash service will generate native Bitcoin, and then they will contribute that to the balance sheet.
I guess. I don't really...
You make the argument, like, why don't you just generate U.S. dollars?
Yeah, I mean, like Facebook or Google could do that.
Or like Block kind of does, right? Like,
yeah, I guess I'm just trying to understand, like, what's... Like, is there some sort of, like, cross-subsidization? Or, like is there an advantage to scale? So, again, huge capital stack lending, I totally see the advantage of scale. Right. I'm not sure I understand the advantage of bringing all these businesses
probably
under one roof.
Buffering ups and downs. Like mining business, I think, can be quite levered. And, you know, in good times, it's really good. And in bad times, it's bad. And I think if you have a big balance sheet, you can buffer against the ups and downs a bit.
That plus, with that much hash rate and all this other liquidity, they wouldn't necessarily need to use a mining pool. Right. And mining pools take charge fees.
Mm. Right.
You know, 1%, 2% or more.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it's a bull market and your margins are huge, who cares about paying a pool? But when you are razor thin margins, and that's definitely the long term where Bitcoin mining is going to be, it's going to be razor thin margins because it's a permission. There's an, it's
only
a no,
stranded energy.
It's a no barrier market, right?
Yeah.
So it'll be the most ruthless market ever.
Yep.
You'll have low margins.
Love to see it.
So if you have low margins, you don't want to pay 1% to 2%, just like small businesses don't want to pay Visa fees, so
you see
Bitcoin, right? But
you could also have cross-selling, too.
So instead of, now, why do pools exist? Why pay that money? It's because of the volatility of mining, and you can go bankrupt.
Right.
If you don't have enough hash rate and you don't have enough liquidity, then you can go bankrupt because you can get on a bad luck streak. You can expect to earn so much per day.
Right.
But if you go weeks or months without mining a block, then you might go bankrupt. But if you're combined with other businesses that have a lot of liquidity and cash flow and can cover that, then you can get by without a third-party pool.
Yeah. And I was also just thinking you could have, I guess, cross-selling of services. So for example, if you have like a big loan with, I guess, Strike or whatever, maybe you get some like Strike premium or whatever, better rates or like cheaper payment services or stuff like that.
Yeah.
So all the messaging seems to be around like, let's build products and services. And I think that's exciting because everything we hear from Strategy, you know, can respect what they're doing, but they're not trying to build products and services. They're saying, let's make a financial service.
They flirted with it and you could see it coming someday. I mean, you wrote up a whole unpublished paper on this thesis.
We got to look back at that because it's funny. I was like, they got to 1%, but they're never going to get to 2%, right?
Yeah.
Well, but again, I mean, and not to Simple and Sailor too much, but I will recommend.
I'm going to.
I think the word I used is fawn.
Yeah. Well, you know, trying to get more with Gen Z now, Gen Alpha. Right? If you haven't listened to his, I actually haven't watched any, or I've only watched a couple of the talks on the Bitcoin Vegas thing. His is, it's just so crisp, so clear. I highly recommend watching it, explaining Stretch. But the thing that I admire about what he's doing right now is it's so focused. It's so crystal clear. Like you could explain, I mean, it's complex, but once he goes through and walks it through, you could explain it to a 5-year-old and she'd be like, this is a loop. All we do is this. And I really like the way that he always talks about focus, right? Like, you know, why would I do a second best product idea if I could just pour more kerosene on my best product idea and that's going to grow faster? So, I mean, I think it's interesting to see a lot of different approaches and like, I hope 21 is obviously successful.
You have 2 microphones for this podcast?
What do you mean? that's my thing, man. But I tend to agree as a mantra in life, simplify, simplify, simplify. And like whenever people start like branching out, it's not really clear to me. It's like, maybe, but.
By the way, little teaser.
Yeah.
Next week on the show, I expect to have a topic with a little partnership with Strategy. So with at least me.
What?
What?
Okay.
You have to wait for next show. That's the teaser.
I guess we have to tune in.
That's the teaser.
So not to.
Don't get too excited about it.
I don't know.
It might even be controversial and we're going to have to spend the whole show next week like talking it out.
Yeah.
I don't know if I should be giving the alpha drop right now or not, but
we'll take it.
Word on the street is Michael Saylor has a stunt double he needs to hire. So Steve has been accused of having a Saylor look.
That's the announcement. But I got a new haircut recently, right? And everyone's commenting it. No one's ever talked about my hair because I don't have great hair.
You got to do this for Halloween.
But the last two haircuts I've got.
We got to do the black Bitcoin shirt, little Bitcoin hair.
Everyone's loving my haircut, but I probably look less like.
You'll have to come in and tell us about capital.
Yeah. Credit. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have the whole shtick down.
Every time.
Anyhow, let's talk about, there's been, dude, you missed a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Like so much has happened in the last 2 weeks. So
catch me up. I've been
under covered Vegas partially. I'm sure we could spend an hour talking about Vegas. But let's move on to PB hosted another hackathon.
Yep. Yeah.
We love hackathons. We love innovation and building. Yep. This one was a little bit different though.
Mm-hmm.
And that it wasn't just PB and it wasn't just Spiral. This was a global hackathon called Hack Nation AI,
mm-hmm.
Organized by 2 MIT alum.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, it's a global. They had like over 5,000 hackers apply. I think 1,600 qualified, largely students,
mm-hmm.
but open to anyone. And they're definitely industry people doing it as well. But I mean, it definitely skews students, which is great because mm-hmm. we've struggled to engage university students here at least, making inroads there too. But anyway. 12 physical hubs around the world is a one-day hackathon.
Mm-hmm.
So it was last Saturday. And so because it was global, you know, it started at 8 a.m. here in California.
Right.
But I mean,
Europe.
There were hubs in all throughout Europe, like Dresden and Munich and Germany. And I think London had one.
Nice. A bunch in India, right?
And there was India, there was Pakistan and Armenia.
Japan?
Not Japan. Maybe next time.
Yeah.
If anyone from Japan is listening,
to the Japanese Nostalgia.
And then in the US, MIT, Stanford, and Presidio Bitcoin. So
nice.
That was cool.
Good company there.
And then the way they run the hackathon, so they have all these participants. When it starts, like the participants don't know what they're going to build when they show up because they have to build one of, it was in this hackathon, five challenges. This is the fifth time they've done this hackathon, by the way. So there were five challenges, and as a participant, you had to choose one of the five challenges. Mm-hmm. And so Spiral sponsored one of the challenges. So that was our like formal involvement. Well, I mean, two ways. One, PB was kind enough to host it, so we were involved in that. And then Spiral put a challenge together, and our challenge was earn in the agent economy.
Nice.
And it was required to use Bitcoin Lightning Network.
Nice.
And then we gave some examples of what you could build, but otherwise, like, let people, you know, creativity flourish and people decide. For us, it was a bit risky and foreign territory because usually when we do hackathons or like pitch our stuff or go to an event, it's a Bitcoin event.
Right.
So everyone there's already a Bitcoiner. Yeah. So they generally kind of like what we had to do. They already have a Bitcoin thing in mind or know how to use Lightning Network or Bitcoin. This was not the case. This is an AI hackathon.
Yeah.
So you could not assume people knew what Bitcoin was, owned Bitcoin, had used Bitcoin, had developed and programmed Bitcoin. You couldn't assume any of that. So that was definitely a challenge. And then secondly, there was no guarantee they're going to work on our challenge. Mm-hmm. Each participant got to choose which challenge they work on. So in the worst case, we could have shown up, sponsored this, gotten all excited, prepared for it, and then no one chose our challenge. That would be bad.
Yeah.
So the good news is there were 73 projects that were submitted that chose our challenge.
Great.
And maybe even more worked on it and didn't submit. I don't know that number. But people, I think we marketed it well. We also offered 30-minute meeting with Jack Dorsey, and Jack gave the 1-minute live pitch Saturday morning.
It's pretty cool.
For the challenge. So yeah. That was definitely, I think, a fan favorite. But also, I think it was a good challenge. I mean, I think we did put time and effort into it to not come across like overly Bitcoining and like make it appeal to people who wouldn't identify as a Bitcoiner. I think we did a good job at that. I think it did resonate with people, and a lot of people chose it. So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
The energy here at PB on Saturday was awesome.
Mm-hmm. How many teams were building at PB?
There were about 40 people in total. Maybe nice. 10 of those were like volunteers, organizers, and 30 builders, and at least 8 teams.
Mm-hmm.
And at least 4 teams were working on our challenge.
Mm-hmm.
There were at least 3 teams that I met that were working on a science challenge.
Cool.
Our friend Adam Jonas from ChainCode is focusing on AI and science now. So he sponsored that challenge.
Cool. That's Fulcrum?
Yeah.
Fulcrum.science?
Yep. Cool. And so, Saturday was good. Good energy, just the right number of people, enough to make it feel alive and a buzz, but not overwhelming. Yeah. I was able to, you know, meet most of the people here, and everyone I met was awesome. In fact, including the not just the participants, but the volunteers that came. You know, there was a woman from NVIDIA who runs like their open source AI software.
Oh, that's awesome!
So I'm like, we need to connect more, right? And there's just several people like that.
Yeah.
So that was great. And then Sunday was the judging, and we had esteemed set of. So each sponsor got to select 3 judges.
Yeah.
And so we selected an esteemed group of judges.
You had esteemed judges and DK.
Well, no, I chose not to judge because I wanted esteemed judges. So DK was kind enough to volunteer, and then 2 people who work on Goose at Block happened to be in town as well, and they judged as well. So on Sunday, the 3 of them and Haley and me. Haley did most of the work from Spiral to make this happen. The 5 of us went down to Stanford together, in a startup lab in Palo Alto. And that was there was judging and then final presentations.
Cool.
So it was overall a really good experience. Glad we did it. There's going to be more. So we're going to figure out, do we keep working with this organization or another one? There are definitely a few areas of improvement, I think, for the hackathon as well. I think some of the maybe best projects actually didn't make it through the judging process.
Really?
So we're evaluating that. But what I definitely know is that it was super healthy to go out there to a non-Bitcoin audience and get them engaged with the tools and the product thinking and the user experience to integrate Lightning Network and Bitcoin.
Okay, so ton of questions. First, I mean, I want to hear who won. And in addition to who won, what were the other projects you like? And then I also want to hear what was like the sort of general, for people that were not already into Bitcoin, I'm assuming some were already Bitcoiners, like, did they come in skeptical? Were they curious? Did they have a, like, were they like, oh, this is cool, they want to keep using it? Like, do they think AI agents are going to like it? Tell me everything.
I have answers to a lot of those, or not all, because we still have a little bit of post-hackathon analysis to do, but I'll get to that in a second. In terms of like, reception of the, bunch of people who are not Bitcoiners and reception to this challenge, there was a woman here who was like a solo project, and she talked to me. She seemed like so eager and focused and good energy. But she was asking me like, well, why not use stablecoins? And so it's good. I mean, it's a very, reasonable question. And she seemed pretty sold on the reasons for Lightning Network. And then she just seemed, she's a very analytical, rational person. So once she heard those reasons, she's like, okay. And then she got to work and built something. So that was cool. And I saw no negativity or questions. Like, and there was a Discord and just all the different input I had, whether it be people in person or on Discord, people around the world, there was no like questioning, like, this is dumb or why Bitcoin. There's none of that. So there's no negativity. I think it was just people were open and curious. So that's part of what you asked about. The 73 submissions and the quality of them and what they did, that's the part where we're still evaluating that because we didn't get the data until like middle of this week.
Got it.
We only got to see the winner present. Mm-hmm. And then, so we do know a couple people that participated. One works for Money Dev Kit and one works at Block. So we already know them and they're super high quality.
Yeah.
I definitely looked at one of them and it was a good project. But so I expect those two to be great projects. We just need to look at the project still. I will say I think the presentation, my guess is there wasn't that much time for the winning team to prepare to present. So that's one thing to look at. Like, can there be more time, or how can the presentations be able to like demonstrate the software a little bit more and better?
Yeah.
That would be good. And then, like I said, the judging process, there's probably some optimizations and tweaks that can be done there as well.
But tell me, I mean, who won in the projects you do know? What did they build? I mean, just high level. Like, was there anything new demonstrated? You're like, oh, that's a great use for Bitcoin.
Well, again, I literally have not seen 72 of the 73 projects. So yeah.
Sum up the winner.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Esteemed judge, DK.
No, I don't want to try to represent it.
So in general, there was a lot of agent marketplaces that were built, at least a couple of the projects here, teams that I spoke to. Interestingly, quick, fun anecdote. One of the teams here, there were four people on the team. They're all graduating university in, probably this month.
Yeah.
And two of them are going to work for the World Bank. And
it was one of the sponsors.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Was the IMF up in there too?
One of the challenges was the
go easy.
The Bank of International.
They didn't sponsor the big
one. One of the challenges was sponsored by World Bank. But the fun part of the story, Max, let me say it. So two of these students are going to work for the World Bank. So it would feel natural to work on the World Bank challenge. And they came here planning to work on the World Bank challenge.
Right.
Because they were aware of it ahead of time, I think. And they switched to work on the Spiral Lightning Network challenge.
That's awesome.
That's awesome, man.
Isn't that a win?
Just win from the inside. Yeah.
Isn't that a win?
What's his name? The Karsten's guy, the BIS. He's you'd recognize him if you saw him here. Maybe get him to the next.
So anyhow, I think to do the projects justice and to speak to them eloquently, let's cover that on a future episode.
Okay. I like that idea.
Yeah. I would say one comment on the ones that I did judge. I think every one of them was an international team. There was a lot from Europe and a lot from India.
Yeah.
So they put together people from all over the place, lots of different perspectives. People were building things in very different ways, different assumptions.
Yeah. Oh, and another important point too, because these participants, you couldn't assume that they're a Bitcoiner. You couldn't assume they had Bitcoin.
Right.
So we felt it was really important to give them a little bit of Bitcoin on mainnet to build, test, and demonstrate their applications.
Cool.
Because like there's different test networks, Testnet and Signet. And
it's not the same drill.
Well, and Lightning Network doesn't really work well on Testnet.
Yeah.
The people don't run nodes, they're not liquidity. So,
right.
So you really need to be, you got to YOLO.
Yeah.
Got to be a mainnet. And we've seen
test
that.
And prod, baby.
Everyone doing vibe coding, anyone doing anything, they're on mainnet, right? But like if you imagine your student that learns at 8 a.m. about this challenge and like, I want to do this challenge, but you don't have any Bitcoin.
Yeah.
How are you going to get, no, not that. Or I mean that too, but like not that. Yeah. How are you going to obtain Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Are you going to KYC in an exchange and wait 2 days for their team to like
and I run approve you? When I tried to do my honey deal.
Buy mining equipment in the next 10 minutes to set up and then mine and get, you know, you're not like, are you going to like, create a service to earn Bitcoin. You're not going to do that in the first 10, 15 minutes.
Right.
So,
bag on Noster. That's
There needs to be some kind of faucet or ability to send a little bit of Bitcoin to participants. So, that we felt that was important. Unfortunately, I did not get around to
itty bitty got demoted.
Oh,
did people ask about that?
Coconut water. Okay. Sorry. We're going to.
Oh, Austin.
Itty bitty.
Yeah, we've been sponsored by Kirkland and the World Bank.
Costco. Alex is loving the suit.
Anyway, there are some things done right, but a lot of things that could improve with managing that. And already we have some vibe coded apps to help us with the faucet.
The episode where Max
listened. I don't know why I guess so, yeah.
Anyway, good morning, Steve. Thank you.
Yeah, that was that. Anything else to say about the hackathon?
No, I mean it was great. It was fun. It kind of reminded me of the hackathon that we had here. Was it about a year ago?
Yeah,
I felt like there were some interesting things, like the way the challenges worked. I think was really good. So if we were to do another hackathon here ever, I think we should consider having different sort of challenge lanes.
Yeah.
And then I really liked. I mean, you know, in person has its place in the world, but also I really like the fact that there were so many projects from all over the world, and so getting more global perspectives, even if it's Presidio Bitcoin hosting, it could still be sort of open to the world, and having people participate remotely, I think,
yeah,
it's a great way to get like more energy on kind of the focus of how do you build on Bitcoin.
Yeah, agreed. And I think I started saying it, but maybe didn't finish it. But I'm convinced that Spiral and PB and my advice to like the Bitcoin community at large is to rethink your schedule, your calendar, meaning and like all the Bitcoin events you're going to, all the Bitcoin hackathons you're going to. You don't have to eliminate that, but maybe substitute one of each or a podcast you go on and try to go to a broader audience. It's a much harder task because they don't naturally want to hear about Bitcoin, right? And we talked about in this episode, like even itty bitty pushing it off to the side. We love itty bitty, but trying to attract a broader audience can be difficult to like hit them over the head with all the reasons you love Bitcoin. I mean, everyone in Bitcoin knows this because if you talk to family members or whatever, it's always a tough sell or whatever.
Right.
So you have to have a different approach, but and it's way harder to do.
Right.
But I think it's absolutely worth venturing out into these new audiences.
Sort of
so that would be my advice to
the needle.
Meet
everyone
people where they are and hear how they think about it and what their concerns are, or what their goals are, and does it fit their goals, or is it just, you know, you're doing it for your ideology's sake, you're doing it because it might actually be a solution to a problem they're experiencing. I didn't know that it's a solution to it.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's time that Bitcoin becomes mainstream. So,
so another thing that you missed, Max, while you're out is we had Builder last Thursday.
Okay.
Yeah. So like 8 days ago.
My favorite builder.
You know, and
whoa.
Again, okay. It was
really great content.
Because we've had some good builders.
So we, you know, we conceived of the idea in this show last June, I believe, or May or June. We immediately put it into action.
Yeah.
Created a monthly meetup called Builder. And we've had it every month since here at PB. And As you guys know, it's spread to other cities. So awesome. It started off, a lot of it was like demonstrating vibe coding and allowing people who are vibe coding and building to show off what they've done. For people who had heard about it or curious and learned, they got to learn. And we had a lot of discussions around it. That's been the core of what Builder's been. And I think that it'll always remain an element. I mean, building is going to be part of Builder, right? Innovation, creativity, building. But a direction we want to go with Builder is to also weave in even more AI stuff and other AI topics, get more into the technology. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what was great about this. Yeah, and we covered OpenClaw, a few months ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Builder and attracted a crazy number of people,
right?
And most of whom were not Bitcoiners. So it was like successful getting people who weren't Bitcoiners here. And then this past week or a week ago, we had two people who were they're the two people who I mentioned were judges along with DK at the hackathon. They both work on Goose. Mm-hmm. And they were in town. I was meeting with them for other stuff, which we can talk about a little bit maybe. Mm-hmm. And so we got them to present on at Builder.
Oh,
so
sweet. Okay.
Mick talked about Mesh LLM.
Yep.
And then
have you seen this before?
I mean, I saw the announcement on Primal and Nostra.
Okay.
And then Dawa presented on Goose Perception. Have you heard of that?
No.
So, but I'll let you describe these and then I'll fill in anything else.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
just because you liked it so much, right?
These projects were awesome.
Sweet.
And none of them are presented as a Bitcoin project. They really feel like basically AI projects. Mm-hmm. But as a Bitcoiner, you're looking, you're like, this is obviously going to be relevant at some point in the development of this. And I mean, in a sense, the only reason to really appreciate Bitcoin is because when it's actually useful, not just for its own sake. So Mesh LLM was the first project. And, you know, we've talked about this idea before of like, how do you create, a bunch of unused compute activity? If you have an unused GPU sitting around, or I think even CPUs, was it? You can use it to like contribute to the network and run jobs and contribute answers back. And there's like a discovery protocol process to find that. I would characterize it as like, I think it works and it's kind of early, but there's things that you might hope for, like there's not a lot of privacy, there's not a lot of verifiable compute, a lot of, there's no like payment or Bitcoin integration, but you could imagine that keep doing this thing. I think it's always best to start with hobbyists, just like Nostra relay runners, effectively, like start with hobbyists, get people who are passionate about the idea and want to see the future and how this is going to work. But it sounds, I was excited to hear that it's like a real project that's made some real progress at this. Like,
are there people already running actual nodes?
Yep.
I don't know if that's the right lingo, but cool. And I told you guys before, and I don't know if he's listening to this podcast, but Christopher David, Open Agents, he's actually gotten a decent amount of traction on Open Agents front recently. Mm. And I think he's aiming to do, I think in the next week or so, the largest decentralized model run ever, which is interesting because I think the largest before was BitTensor, which we hear a lot of shilling on that. And I think it just had another totally unpredictable collapse. But it would be awesome. I don't know. I think you guys are already in contact. If what Block is working on and Open Agents converge on the same standard, that'd be great to see this grow.
Yeah. I don't know all of, is it also a mesh network or kind of a peer-to-peer discovery thing?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how he's doing it. But the central thesis is that they're already paying out Bitcoin. So the central thesis is I plug it in GPU, I get paid Bitcoin.
And I think one of the big questions for a system like this is it better for training? Is it better for inference?
Totally.
In the case of inference, there's challenges like you
verifiable compute.
Well, verifiable compute is certainly a challenge, but like what kinds of inference workloads are you going to handle best?
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get fastest time to token or something, first token. You're going to get maybe async jobs that'll work well.
Totally.
So figuring out exactly what shape does demand look like and where does it come from? I think today it's all hobbyists, which is great, but it does feel like it's a substrate which you could explore a lot and you might be able to find
And interesting, we've had a couple conversations on the show that there's one, even if it takes off at the protocol level, there's opportunity for companies to do things like lending around this, but also to basically go out and do that business development work and finding those markets that would actually tap into this compute and being that on-ramp. And I know I said this kind of as a joke last time, but like, I think it's, the more I thought about it, I actually think it's, you know, great. I think you're going to have a lot of businesses, like anyone would, you know, if they have whatever, some spare capacity that's super cheap, would like more lead gen, right? So like, if you do the sort of calculation and say, hey, you know, I could pay whatever $500 and I know it's going to close whatever $5,000 or even $600 yeah. worth of business for me, it's always worth it to add that marginal profit.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think someone basically just has to go out and do the work of finding companies where, yeah, it's like super slow, maybe it gets pushed to the end of the queue overnight, whatever, but it's like, I don't need it to happen, but it's free money if I
do. Well, also, you know, I think we often probably bias towards our experience using the internet.
Yeah.
And if you really imagine a future where agents are using the internet,
yeah.
that's going to be like all the traffic. And they don't really mind if they have to wait around, you know, yeah. 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 10 minutes.
It's
nowhere near as bad as if we are using the internet having to wait around. So the idea of asynchronous, always available, like kind of slow calls is actually, to me, feels like it's very cheap
yeah.
and slow is actually a huge, huge market.
Yeah,
it's
I agree.
Not just like,
it's a whole
oh,
new market
I typed
too.
Something, I need to just have the answer right away. So I think that market, our instincts underappreciate how big that probably is.
What do you think if you were trying to get the, so hobbyists are obviously like, you know, P0. Beyond that, if you had to try and find that first source of demand to demonstrate this thesis, where would you be looking?
Well, so I don't know how tightly coupled this is into like the Goose team, but when you've got like an open source, mm-hmm. you know, IDE and it needs to make
yeah.
calls,
yeah,
I mean, you could
point.
Kind of,
just
it
route
would
there.
Be a natural way to route them there.
Also yeah. another, so, I think maybe we naturally think of this peer-to-peer network as a public network,
mm-hmm.
In which case then concerns of privacy come up and like payments and stuff like that.
Not having malicious like
code. We can talk about that a little bit. But another deployment is not a public network.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine you're a company with like 10,000 employees.
Yeah, yeah.
And they all have 10,000 powerful computers.
Yeah.
I mean, just a MacBook Pro.
And then trust is enough.
Right. And then you can... Well, then you don't have to worry about privacy because it's confined to your own company.
Yeah.
And it's doing company stuff. So
yeah, it's a great
you
idea.
Know,
really
and then,
good idea.
And then you can utilize this spare capacity.
And you
so
could
instead
also...
of instead of being like Cerebrus or OpenAI or Anthropic or any kind of cloud provider, you just utilize your own resources.
I mean, I'm just thinking like so many ideas are coming to my head right now, which is we gotta do the full jam. We probably won't have time today to hear what you guys did with the Spiral Retreat. But I mean, I'm seeing so many things, like you could have basically a bunch of micro entrepreneurs or like, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of these, like, you're not AWS, but you're also not like a dude with a computer. And you have these kind of like medium sized, maybe you've got like a bunch of warehouses in India and you're like, okay, we could do like a relatively you know, medium sized player for compute there. And I think one thing that I would love to see that would be super cool, maybe as a hobbyist project, but that could grow is you could also start to demonstrate this, you know, in the same way that Bitcoin mining, can go to the stranded energy source, so could this. So you could be like, all right, you know, I've got whatever really cheap hydro or solar in Kenya or Arizona and start to demonstrate also for sovereign reasons, like we're going to build this like cloud, maybe it's a multinational corporation with like different nodes in different countries, which gives you some jurisdictional, you know, potential arbitrage, but also the ability to go totally off, off grid, which potentially could drive much lower cost. So that's one thing I would love to see happen.
Yeah.
Good compute is the future of government.
Computers is the future of everything. And that reminds me of this charity idea. I need to follow up with Nick and MDK and some other folks. Like we talked about this idea at lunch, which I think is genius. So if anyone's listening, this is a great idea. But the future of charity is just like pay some Bitcoin, run some cycles, get some tokens for whatever you think. Like if it's protein folding or whatever the computer's yeah. doing.
But what's funny, I was just having a conversation this morning with someone. You know, it's been literally decades since I cared about how much my computer, what its resources
yeah, right.
are,
yeah.
RAM and yeah, yeah. CPU and gigger. I mean, like
time to nerd out.
You know, back in the 80s and 90s or whatever, it's
build
like
your own,
you just couldn't wait until the next computer came out because it went from like 2 megabytes
yeah.
to 4 megabytes of RAM. And that was like massive win. Or the,
yeah.
you know, when the 386 SX came out, that was
yeah.
the first 32-bit microprocessor in the world. And then Pentium.
150 baud modem to it,
right?
$300
yeah.
modem. Oh, yeah.
But like, I haven't thought about that or worried about that. I literally don't even check my Mac when I buy a new
yeah,
one. I just like, don't
no,
care.
Whatever.
It just works. Like, I care more about, like, does it have a better battery life?
Yeah.
Stuff like that. But now, with LLM models, which are very resource hungry,
yep.
I care. And so like I'm running Gemma 4 on my laptop and then but I had to pick the model size.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, well, how much memory did I happen to choose with my MacBook? So I looked it up and then tried to match it. So
this is the first time I ever really tried to, I got to max out my memory because like I want to be running AI stuff.
So too, and specifically, the RAM. That's great. I'm like,
that's the thing.
Great demand.
And I hope Apple lets you like one day be sick if you could actually, and I think companies like Framework, whatever, that are more customizable have an opportunity here. If you want to go, no, I don't want 128, terabyte, baby, let's go.
Is it rumor in the last day or two, I think, is that there's going to be a MacBook Ultra released?
Oof.
So MacBook Pro may be coming to an end and it's going all Ultra.
Oh, Ultra. Nice.
So I had another two things I wanted to mention on this because I think this is such a promising area. One thing is I told you guys, Anjali's kind of been taking the lead here, but we've been starting to do more of these like AI dinners and stuff. Mm-hmm. We did another one that was quite cool. Shout out to Anjali. Because of scheduling, sadly, I had to miss this day, but she's actually with the Commonwealth Club hosting Daniela Amodei. I think I got the name right. Mm-hmm. The co-founder of Anthropic, which is pretty cool. So she's
former
stealthily
FYSK speaker, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Back when they were the Series B, I think,
Investor in that COVID? That
should have been.
I know, it should have been.
Cursor right after the seed.
I know, I remember that one. Oh, yeah. Painful. Whatever.
The ones that got away.
Yeah, you know, it is what it is. One of the without mentioning names because Chatham House, but some pretty popular AI companies basically said that like for all of their non-coding tasks, the kind of takeaway was everyone still wants like, you know, top of the line, like Opus 4.7 or whatever the Codex model is. Like no one's like getting rid of that. But for everything else, customer service or whatever, it was a general theme I saw where all of these companies have totally switched to open source and it's pure cost sensitive. Yeah. And so if you could come in with like an open source router and just be like, hey, for
it's
all
even
of
more than that though.
What do you mean?
So first of all, I'm seeing the same, exact same thing from every data point I've learned recently.
Yeah.
And it's definitely cost and economics is one, mm-hmm. but two, it's privacy.
Yeah.
So two levels of privacy. If you're a corporation and you're using AI for your own corporation, you can sign enterprise agreements with Anthropic or OpenAI or whatever and legally binding. Cross your fingers.
This data will never get leaked.
Cross your fingers. They say they're going to delete it. They say they're not going to use it.
But, super trustworthy.
You know, that's one approach. I mean, you should do it if you're going to use their models.
Yeah. I mean, it's better than
not. So at least it's better than not.
Yeah.
But even better is if they don't have your data. So there's privacy for your own corporation, but also if your corporation delivers products to customers and those customers might trust your corporation with their data.
Totally.
But the customer doesn't really think about or didn't really sign up for like, you know, Sam Altman having your data or Elon having your data or whatever, right? Yeah. So if you can, that's another huge win is privacy.
Yeah.
And then a third area is, you know, even though Anthropic and OpenAI have great products, great models, optimized in certain ways. There's so many different variables when it comes to this stuff and customizability. And every corporation, every product might want to optimize things and you can't optimize every variable.
Right.
Or you can't have peak on every variable. Yeah, so you have trade-offs. Everything has trade-offs, right?
That's the, nature of reality.
You know, and so there are going to be cases and probably many cases where the defaults or the choices, the fixed choices that you have as an OpenAI or Anthropic customer doesn't work best for your product or your business.
Right.
So if you use an open model, you have way more flexibility. You can do what you want.
Yeah.
So there's at least three big reasons today to use an open model. And like you said, for most tasks, they're good enough.
Yeah. And cheaper.
Yeah.
So one just thought that comes to mind, and I have to ask you a question. It's a bit off topic, but I got to do it. So,
and we've got 3 minutes, and we should also talk Goose Perception.
Okay, so I want to hear about that. So, really quick question for you then on this. Hearing you say that, the first thought that comes to mind is this seems like an amazing opportunity for Block. And I think about, you know, Amazon, right? Like they sell stuff online, but what's their real business? Like, that's a whatever business. The real business is AWS.
Yeah.
And why did they get there? Because they realized, we need this. And then, we can offer this to everyone else. I will just say, like, full stop. If Block were able to offer a sort of like, maybe, you know, if they acquire some companies or whatever, but like Enclave-based open source model compute, all day, every day, I would rather just like bet on Jack Dorsey not jacking all of my information rights than any of the companies currently fix. And I could see a real niche there for like Block is like the like least evil AI provider, and also with more
endorsement.
I know,
least evil
with the more cryptographic
real
proof,
fan
not evil, but the least evil.
Yeah.
Corporations are going to corporation, but if you got to do that, I mean, that to me seems like a huge opportunity.
But
I would.
But even better is
provably
do no evil. But even better is can't do evil,
exactly.
Right? And so,
yes.
If there are companies that are offering like sovereign AI, like sovereignty by design, that would be powerful. Where you might offer service. I mean, kind of like
Maple AI, right?
Exactly.
Or like the, I mean,
which maybe gets acquired.
Like the BitKey product.
Yeah.
Like it's a company. Like there is a block server in the mix, a block controlled key in the mix, but it offers you good UX, good services. It makes your experience better as a customer, but you don't have to trust Block. So you can imagine
compute from Block.
You can imagine AI products that fall into that as well.
I love that. I really hope you'll do that.
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
We can go a little over because we started late.
Okay.
But we still don't have nearly enough time to cover everything. But one of the topics that we tweeted about that we're going to cover is like frontier models taking over the world.
Yep.
We're kind of backing into that conversation.
Right.
We're answering a no, right? But
but
let's talk about, I mean, we have talked on a previous episode about the concern. I mean, it is true that like Anthropic and OpenAI are killing it. Their models are super powerful to the point that they're not releasing their latest models, citing like, you know, security risks. And the now the White House is inserting themselves, controlling whether Anthropic can even launch their own products, which is really dangerous territory if the governments can like dictate whether a private company can launch products or not.
DK is a big fan of government.
Yeah. So, but yeah, and then there's discussion about like Mythos. Is it a myth or not? I mean, is it truly a stepwise function or is it incrementally better? There's, you know, some people have tuned Opus or with it like making a smarter harness and claim that it matches the performance of Mythos. So we don't know the actual details there, but we certainly know that Mythos is not publicly available.
Yeah.
It was reported that Anthropic did want to release it to more organizations, and at least the White House is suggesting they don't. I don't know if there's actual enforcement or action there or not. And we know that like in the future, there's definitely going to be cases where there are powerful models that truly are a step function capability and only some people have access to. It could just be the company that created it.
Right.
Or the government takes it over or what have you. I guess the topic we talked about a few weeks ago and I think we're going to cover here is like, if you're a corporation that is, on board with from hierarchy to intelligence, what Roloff and Jack wrote about recently, and fully committed to transforming your organization to be intelligence based, and it's solely in your single vendor locked in,
right?
Like you're like, well, Anthropic has a great model, they're leading model in the world, and they have an amazing software stack around that,
right?
Or substitute OpenAI, either one. And clearly, they're very good products, very good bundled package, and you could do great things with an organization with one of those. But do you really, if your corporation, the DNA of it, it's like totally dependent on this. Do you really want to bank on one vendor?
Yeah.
So I think sovereignty by design is super important. The question is like, how big a risk is that? A lot of corporations are going to pick OpenAI or Anthropic and go down that path and get locked in. And then the danger, of course, is like...
Then they eat your lunch.
Yeah, I mean, they can just increase their prices and take your margins away from you. They can move into your business. And like now all of a sudden, Anthropic's in Figma's business. And
yeah. I mean, DK shared an article called The Big Rug a couple weeks ago or whenever you shared it. I mean, I thought it was just spot on. And I want to be clear, when I said that a lot of these companies are moving to open source models, it was for the non-mission critical stuff, like customer service is cool, whatever. But like for coding, they're all using Anthropic or Codex because it's just better. And so I actually do think, you know, I stand by the 3 or 4, maybe 5 companies are going to still be the lion's share of the S&P 500 the next couple of years. And I think it's a huge risk because all these companies that are building on top of them, like if you're literally just giving them all of your data, of course they're going to eat your, why wouldn't they?
Is Block one of those 5 or 6 companies?
I wasn't including them in there, but if you can provide a meaningful differentiator, confidential compute, privacy, and trustability could put them in that list.
Okay. All right. That's the bar. Hopefully Jack's listening.
Yeah.
So
you heard it here.
But I think what is very important for most organizations is on day one to be thinking about supporting multiple models, having that flexibility.
Yeah.
Whether we call it, I don't know if sovereignty is the right word or not, but just choice, freedom.
Yeah.
Because sure, today for building software within your organization, probably you want to use Anthropic or OpenAI. But as you said earlier, there's so many other like corporate tasks and things that AI massively 10x, 100x improve for your employees, but they don't need the most advanced models.
Right.
The open models work today, right? So you want an infrastructure within your company that can support different models simultaneously. Also, you might want to run those models in different locations. Some are going to run on Anthropic servers. Some might run on in the cloud servers that you as the company it's your own data center, or you go with like a Cerebrus or some other third party, but it's not the big AI model company.
Yeah.
Or you might use this mesh LLM network on all your company's computers, or some, of course, just run on your local computer. So I think being flexible where the model runs and which model runs, super important for almost all organizations.
Yeah.
Honestly, like except for like individual retail, like an individual consumer, if you just want to build apps, okay, great. You know, download Cloud Code.
Yeah.
Use Codex, pay them. You're probably going to be really happy.
Until you have no token left, but
if you're doing an activity that requires that power, then that's going to be a good market. But for any multi-person organization or any kind of organization of significance, which can range from open source to small business to medium to large, I think you need to have this like flexibility in mind.
Okay. Last question. I know you want to talk about this stuff. Maybe we'll have to say that for last week, but I have to put you on the spot, Steve, because you shared a tweet a while ago. I'm sure it was tongue in cheek, unless it's not. I saw that X Money is using cash tags. Comment?
Yeah, you mentioned, isn't that like some kind of baseless rumor or something?
I don't know. You shared a tweet in the thread.
Is X Money launched now or no?
I don't know.
I think someone tweeted or Stacker News or something like, Elon's going to buy Block or something. I don't know. I don't think there's any
comment
substantiation to that rumor.
Just checking.
Yeah. I think there's maybe a better chance that Block buys PPJ.
Both seem reasonable. PPJ is part of the X acquisition? I mean,
anyhow, I believe Block can thrive as an independent company. And like I like your thinking about what Block can do as well.
Yeah,
maybe in future episodes we can explore that more.
It's great.
Also,
I like having a player who's out there who's not in the current race in the same way. Because I think the OpenAI versus Anthropic race is kind of like off to the races. They're kind of neck and neck. One leapfrogs the other, but they're effectively building the same thing today.
Yeah.
And Block is not in that race.
They're credibly neutral.
Apple's not in that race. Google's in a slightly different type of race.
Google's in every race.
Yeah, but they're not in the we're going to build a better model race, which is kind of they are, but that's not their main lead. They're like we have TPUs and we have data centers and we have cloud computing and
they're financing Anthropic, right? So
my point is, I think having Block as an independent approach to this market that can play at a different layer in a sense is a very very healthy dynamic and might turn out to be the way you actually coordinate across these players.
And one other comment, maybe there's like a partnership with Block and Apple or something in the future, but one other comment from this dinner is that, you know, most of these people, some of them were kind of like, you know, into open source stuff, but one thing that came across from the whole conversation, including people at the closed labs, was by the end, everyone's like, I really wish there was a way for me to use frontier models without sharing my data. Like no one is excited about, like everyone was like, yeah, it's like, it's going to be like Facebook all over again. It's like, it's cool and it's valuable. And like, no one's going to not use it because the value is so great. And like, everyone understands that. But, you know, down the line, everyone realizes you're going to get rugged. So if there's an option to use great models and not get rugged, that's a huge market.
I think it's going to come down to cheapest tokens. And today, that's probably Google who can provide the cheapest tokens.
Right.
But in the future, you could imagine being able to do cheaper tokens.
On a mesh network.
Edge computers or mesh networking or something. I think that's, AI is going to play out cheapest tokens, right?
I think cheapest tokens, but I wouldn't underestimate that there really will be a market opportunity for credibly not sharing my data.
Yeah. I think that's a flavor of, like a shape of it, yeah.
So we'll talk more about Block and maybe even Spiral AI stuff in future episodes.
Yeah, love it.
Excited to do that. Maybe we should wrap soon, I don't want to rug our audience, and we tweeted out another topic so we can spend a minute on it, which is like, I think it was about SF AI dominant. So we're so back. we're all advocates of San Francisco Bay Area. We've lived here for a long, long time, pre-COVID, during COVID, and post-COVID. Mm-hmm. We've seen so much like nonsense and crap on social media bashing San Francisco. A lot of it, which is like, it's true, but it's not the complete picture.
You can cherry pick the tweakers. But.
So I think all three of us at least would say that the net, it's
awesome.
Wonderful to live here.
Yeah. It's great.
And work here. It's great for career. And so if you work in AI, it's great for you. I mean, this is the epicenter of AI. Yeah. And of course, one of the reasons we started PB is we think that it can be a great place for working on Bitcoin stuff as well.
Yeah.
But we, I think it was Elad, right? Elad Gil tweeted out some data on, I think it was the metric was market capitalization of AI companies.
Yeah.
And I mean, we all know like Silicon Valley and the Bay Area are almost always dominant when you look at any technology metric, be it venture capital invested or market capitalization or just simply, you know, NVIDIA, Apple, Google, Facebook, Stripe, et cetera, Block. OpenAI, Anthropic.
I mean, it just goes on and on.
Sorry, I said a minute. So, but the data presented was like, I think it was like 91 or 92% of AI market capitalization is in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then like everyone else is like 1%, 1%, less than 1%, less than 1%.
Yeah.
It was just unbelievable.
Still an SF story.
The dominance.
Yeah.
And if that's only going to, if you believe that AI only continues to grow, then this only continues to grow.
Yeah. So I think PB is well situated to be here for the intersection of Bitcoin and AI, and just the ethos that we bring at PB, I think, is healthy for everyone in the Bay Area for AI. The ethos meaning like sovereignty, decentralization, security, privacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we can be a big value add to the broader AI community 100%. In the Bay Area.
Build a bridge.
And by the way, my own personal take on that, despite you know, living here for a long time and being a huge fan, I do think the world's better off if it's spread out more.
Yeah.
Right.
I think 90%+ of the value here is not healthy.
But you have to meet reality where it is.
But you have to meet reality. But also, just I mean, just I do get frustrated by people saying like, it, you know,
it's over.
Miami.
Remember when it was the next Detroit?
Next Detroit, or like Miami is taking over, Austin taking over. Right. It's like, come on.
And San Francisco, I mean, now I don't think people have realized yet. There are some stats. I want to get these right the next week, Dakota, but like, I think it's easily past New York as a financial capital world too now. As you see OpenAI and Anthropic and these companies, Google just absolutely surge. Like, it's shocking. I don't think people have realized it, but I think even New York is fading.
And it's kind of a cultural capital. Like it is. I mean, Silicon Valley feels like
something has
Hollywood
popped off.
In a sense.
I mean, Anjali's showing me like people like models and stuff are moving here now, which is like, what? I mean,
that last happened when MySpace had parties.
Yeah, exactly. You could imagine why, but you know.
So Matt Coates says Balaji is saying the opposite, and that Silicon Valley is may go to zero. Well, funnily enough,
I think he also said Ethereum is a good thing. So
funnily enough, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, I had dinner with Balaji in New York, and he's like, "Steve, this is the last time you'll ever see me." It's in the United States.
Yeah.
He was, I mean, this is, so years ago, he was sold on like, the U.S. is basically going to go bankrupt. And,
and
he tweets about this all the time too. I love Balaji. He's like one of the biggest idea people I've ever met. So I always, you know, he's super smart. He ties things together in unique ways. So I love reading everything he has to say. But
he's
like
a great thinker.
But like, you know, he's
also wrong on
this. But he's, you know, I mean, which comes with the territory.
Yeah.
If you come up with thousands
of ideas
and toss out novel stuff.
Yeah.
Most are going to be wrong.
Totally.
But that's super valuable for the world. I think he's wrong on this account.
To be fair to Balaji, I've learned a lot from him over the years. A lot of his ideas are truly thought-provoking. And like, you know, if you're in the business of venture capital and, you know, whatever thinking, and like your business is to put out provocative ideas. And the nature of venture capital is like, you don't need to be right all the time. In fact, it's much better in many ways to be very wrong occasionally, but be very right on some things that win big.
Yeah, you bury your losers.
Whatever. It doesn't matter. All you need is one to knock apart. So in fairness to him, I will also say, while I think he's been wrong on certain things around crypto, and obviously the San Francisco thing is just a bad take, I do agree with him that countries like India and Asia are going to continue to rise too. It's not like San Francisco is the only place. Like Asia is going to play a major role in all this for sure.
Yeah, so that's the point I was going to make too. I mean, he moved to Singapore, and so he's like in that region now. So hearing his perspective, it's one thing to like we can hypothesize about Asia and stuff and read information, but if you live in the region, you're going to pick up different data sources, talk to different people, and so it's super. So even if you disagree with conclusions, it might inform your own conclusions by listening to books like Bology. But I don't think San Francisco Bay Area is going to zero.
Now the only question is for a city of only 800,000 people and like way too many people getting rich, competing for the few houses and stuff. When are we ever going to see housing laws relaxed in San Francisco? Is that ever going to happen?
San Francisco?
Yeah.
Are you running for office?
I wouldn't bet on it.
Maybe one day.
Yeah. Well, do we love the Presidio?
Oh, fuck yeah.
Do we want the best. Trump, building up?
Now I understand the NIMBY.
Now you're a NIMBY.
Oh, no.
Do you want all this green space and beauty to go away and we just have concrete?
I mean, I would have to say just like...
I don't.
the sunset, the Richmond, maybe South Bay makes sense. But I mean, obviously the Presidio is a treasure. But at the same time, it's kind of like, I mean, man. It's going to be a problem if we don't really increase housing. Well, at least, or else it's going to be a city of just like, if you weren't early to Anthropic.
Midwest has a lot of land.
Yeah, well.
I think the innovation is going to come from inventing new forms of transportation and making energy cheaper and making it easy to go in and out of places and to create places to live that don't maybe currently have a lot of water, for example. So I think there's
desal, solar.
A lot of stuff. What if you could live in, Nevada and commute in here for 30-minute commute?
Driverless.
Yeah, that's all fine.
Or self-driving car.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also wouldn't mind seeing San Francisco more like Tokyo. So.
Yeah, I like that. You've seen Big Hero 6, right? That's
Big who?
Is that what you're quoting? Is Big Hero 6? Isn't that the... No, you said San Francisco.
I've heard that from multiple people, so I don't know.
Oh, I think it's from a Disney movie, Big Hero 6, where they actually have set in this... hybrid of San Francisco and Tokyo. It's really cool. You should check out the visuals.
I might like that because I love San Francisco and I love Tokyo.
The visuals are...
Me too. We get better food, cheaper, better green tea. And DK is always...
Apparently we need better barbecue because Anthony was saying he was disappointed in comparing to Austin.
Seeing as I'm from Memphis, I would have to agree, but sadly, I no longer eat that. So.
I've got a barbecue rack for you.
Yeah. Okay, well, tell Anthony.
DK's always bringing the alpha, often from Gen Alpha. His Disney barbecue rack.
Anyway, all right. Been a great episode.
Let's wrap it.
Can't wait for next week.
All right.
See you, everyone.
Bye, guys.
Yeah.